Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as U.S. President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
Radio from Tehran. We're now crossing over live to Press TV headquarters for a special program on the occasion of the first anniversary of the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Let's cross over to Press TV.
Baghdad. I want to welcome my guests to this program. We can talk a bit about not only the general, but the effects of what has happened since his assassination, since his martyrdom, and what it means for this region and the world. Out of Tehran, from the University of Tehran, I'd like to welcome Mr. Hamid Mousavi, and out of Beirut, Professor of International Relations from Lebanese University, Mr. Jaman Wakim. Welcome both of you to the program. We'll start this off with Hamid here in Tehran. It has been 1 year since the martyrdom of General Soleimani. The overall effect that it has had for the region, specifically, let's look at Iraq and what happened right after it, and the call for the American troops to leave not only Iraq, but the region.
Yes, so the initial aim of the Trump administration was to pressure Iran and to reduce Iran's influence in the region. Nevertheless, the actual effect of the assassination has been the reverse. It has actually not really changed its regional policies. Quite the contrary, it's been the United States that's been on the retreat, with the United States reducing troop levels in both Iraq, Afghanistan, and in Syria. So rather than actually increase U.S. power in the region, it's had the negative effect of actually reducing U.S. influence in the region. And if we look at this from a public appearance standpoint as well, the actual assassination was an illegal act because it wasn't sanctioned by any international body such as the UN Security Council, and also Iran and the United States at the time were not at war. So actually assassinating an official Iranian general who was visiting Iraq on a normal real passport, and in fact Qasem Soleimani was scheduled to meet the Iraqi Prime Minister the very next day, brought a lot of criticism both within the region and in fact in the United States, with many politicians and analysts condemning what Donald Trump did. So I don't think it has actually reached the objectives the Americans were looking for.
Well, Jamal Ahmed talked about the criticism by various international entities after this terrorist attack. But in general, I mean, you're a professor of international relations. When we look at the illegality of what has taken place, and we look at how the different governments or entities responded, would you say that many of these Western governments basically were hand in hand with the United States? And on the one hand, perhaps they didn't like the timing and possible ramifications, but they were not sorry for what the Trump administration did.
Well, definitely they were not sorry for what the administration did, the Trump administration. Especially that we need not forget the fact that the West in general has a racist perception of our world, of our countries, our people, and our civilization. So as Arabs, as Muslims, as non-Europeans. So they always have this prejudice against non-European cultures, non-Western cultures. So that's why for them it was acceptable to target an official, a government official in acting position. So he was still active in his position, yet he was targeted, and the Trump administration tried to put him on equal footing with Osama bin Laden. But the difference is great. First, Osama bin Laden was a renowned terrorist, acknowledged by the whole world as a terrorist. Whereas in the case of General Soleimani, who was an Iranian official. So this could be considered as an act of war from one state against the other, assassinating a top general without even declaring war. So this, according to international law, should have indicted the United States of America. However, based on the bias in the international law and international institutions, and due to Western hegemony over global affairs, we didn't see such an act. Had it been the other way around, this might have given a pretext for a war from the damaged party. In this case, for example, Iran. Mm-hmm. So I believe that this was the reason why we didn't see any indictment by Western powers to this assassination, to this crime, actually. This was also the reason why the United States, in the United States, there were no indictment of the act taken or the decision taken by the president. Of what are the effect or the impact of this decision? I believe that in the minds of the Americans and mainly Donald Trump, maybe he had in mind that this would undermine what he considers as Iranian influence in the region, because General Soleimani was like the nut that linked all anti-imperialist, anti-Western resistance movements in the region together.
Stay with me, Jamal. Hamid, I want to pick up right there what Jamal said about General Soleimani being the epitome of anti-imperialism, anti-hegemon. And he also talked about this predisposed condition of Europeans as far as looking down on others. And, of course, we saw so many countries in the world come together against Syria, supporting the terrorists in Syria, and we saw General Soleimani and others, and of course what they did and gave them a defeat for a major plan that they had implemented. How much does all of this play in this? This perspective of these Western countries or officials, and then having someone for this region going up against the world and implementing a plan that stop the terrorists in their tracks?
Well, I think we're seeing a very important double standard by the Europeans, whereby they criticize American actions in the region on a rhetorical level, but they're not really willing to take any action. So let's go back and remember how all of this instability in the Middle East started. This was when the United States decided to invade Iraq illegally in 2003 without the permission of the UN Security Council. And that war led to around 1 million civilian deaths out of a country of almost around 30 million. So it was hugely devastating. And that created a void where we saw the rise of terrorist groups such as ISIS. Now, again, with regards to ISIS, the official position of Western governments were that they were completely against it. And, of course, ISIS was a threat to them because of the terrorist actions it was taking in European capitals. Nevertheless, even in these European countries, they were allowing so-called fighters to leave these countries and go to Syria and fight, which was essentially joining extremist groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra as well as ISIS. Now, it was Qasem Soleimani who actually came into the field and started to fight these terrorists on the ground. The Americans supposedly were conducting bombing campaigns, but they never put boots on the ground. It was actually Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force who was doing the fighting in Syria against ISIS, and that led actually to a lot of martyrs. So rather, the Americans didn't lose a single soldier to the fight against ISIS. It was Qasem Soleimani who was fighting it. And this wasn't only a fight to keep Iran safe, but it was a fight that was actually benefiting a numerous countries, including European countries, which are now safer because ISIS has been defeated.
Well, that's an interesting point that you made, Hamid, that even it benefited European countries. And yet, as you said, they did not come out very strongly and condemn his assassination, nor did we hear any calls from them and telling the United Nations to actually set up a committee to investigate this and for the perpetrators to be punished. What about that, Jamal? I mean, there's this double standard that you alluded to earlier. But I want to broaden it a little bit in looking at the United Nations role. We have seen the United Nations, of course, led by the United States, even put no-fly zones on entities, sanction entities, and yet the United States committed this terrorist attack openly and admitted to committing this terrorist attack, and nothing. So what does that say?
I don't believe that the United Nations has an independent role. It's an accessory. It has been an accessory of the United States foreign policy ever since its installment in 1945, and it became an accessory of the State Department, the American State Department, after 1991, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc. So the United Nations have always been like a platform for the United States to promote its own interests, and that's why not only based on a structure that gives, let's say, privileges to the United States, but also it always serves as a tool in order to undermine the interests of power of anti-Western powers and promote Western interests, especially American interests. So look at the budget, for example. The half of the budget of the United Nations is paid off by the United States, other agencies, and the agencies that are not supportive or the ones that do not abide by American policies, they are deprived from finance the way it is the case of UNESCO, for example. So the United Nations have always played the role of accessory of American policies. Another tool was NATO, for example, and this is no secret. This has been subject to thousands and thousands of research papers and books by mainstream and anti-mainstream scholars who have always criticized the role of the United Nations and its lack of objectivity whenever it came to American intervention, American led policies, and American wars waged without any let's say cover by international law.
Well, Jamal, so, but doesn't that sorry to interrupt you, but doesn't that basically send a message to countries that they cannot depend on the United Nations, especially countries that are anti-imperialism, anti-hegemony? They cannot depend on the United Nations, thus they must be strong defensively and able
definitely
to fend for themselves, because definitely the so-called international community is not going to come and help them.
Definitely. This has always been the case of any power that wanted to have an independent choice, let's say, and that wanted to protect its sovereignty. Long before Iran, we had the case of China that was not a member of the United Nations until the early 70s. And China had to acquire bases of power, including strengthening its army, acquiring nuclear weapons, in order to defend itself from continuous American threats against it. So, and it only acquired a seat in the United Nations. It was acknowledged as a state by the United Nations in the early 1970s when it was suitable to American interests that were trying to drive a wedge between Russia and China, both communist countries at the time. So, same happened with Cuba, for example. Mm. Cuba, which wanted to be a sovereign country, which didn't want to abide by the American will, had to endure the longest embargo in history, imposed on it since 1960 until the present day. Mm-hmm. So this is also the case of, for example, of Venezuela. So I'm giving the example of different states with different state ideologies. So if someone wants to justify the hostility of the West towards Iran because of Islam or because of it being an Islamist country, I gave the example of a communist, secular communist country,
right,
both in China and in Cuba.
Okay.
We gave a third example. So this has always been the case of the United States with powers that were not willing to abide by its will.
Okay, stay with me, Jamal. Stay with me. Let me get Hamid back in on this conversation. Hamid, when we look at basically the unbelievable mind strategically of General Soleimani in encountering so many plots from so many different directions. He put himself in danger when towns were basically surrounded by the terrorists, and he made sure that he went right in the middle to direct it and was successful at that. He was symbolic of ensuring security in the region. I want to look at that aspect as far as strategically the level that he was on when he was up against, whether we're talking about the U.S. and its allies or we're talking about the Saudis and their money in the region, but basically so many countries at the same time, but was able to execute in a very strategic and successful way. How do you think that that played in this role of these Western governments basically wanting to stop him?
Yes, so as you mentioned, he was a very hands-on kind of a guy, and he was also very experienced. I mean, he was one of the important generals of Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, where Saddam Hussein attacked Iran. So he had military experience since then, and also more than 20 years as the leader of the Quds Force, which is the external arm of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. The important thing here is, especially in the case of Syria, the situation was very complicated. I mean, on the one hand, you had Saudi money coming in. On the other, you had support from countries such as Turkey, which were allowing safe passage of fighters coming in and joining ISIS. And then on the other hand, you had the U.S., which on the surface were saying that we are fighting ISIS, but at the very least, they weren't doing very much, but there was also even rumors as well as accusations that they were even facilitating the rise of ISIS. And we have to remember around 6 years ago where ISIS had conquered a large part of Syria and the top one-third of Iraq, and they were on their way to Baghdad. This was a time where, you know, ISIS was unstoppable. There was really no one that could stop them. And that's when Qasem Soleimani came in and they started to push back on ISIS. Now, the important thing here is if we're talking on a just level and we want to be honest and truthful with each other, the Europeans and even the Americans should have actually thanked Qasem Soleimani, because ISIS, while anti-Shia and anti-Iran, they were also anti-West and anti-Christian, and they were responsible for numerous terrorist actions. Nevertheless, unfortunately, the Trump administration decided to assassinate him on the basis that they thought that that was going to severely hamper Iran's power and influence in the region. And as we mentioned, that hasn't really happened in the past year.
Well, Jamal, what about that, what Hamid has just said and talking about how Daesh was anti-Shia, anti-humanity, basically, if we look at it, and also as far as the Europeans caused them a lot of problems. So what does this mean when we see an entity like the United States regime and deciding to assassinate the person who has been the most effective in fighting this terrorist group? What does it mean? Does it mean that the United States basically wants this region to be chaotic? Does the U.S. want the European area also to be chaotic and plagued by terrorism? What does it all mean?
Definitely the United States wanted to generate chaos in the region. Not only in our region, but also in Central Asia and in Eastern Europe, as a way to undermine both its allies and foes, and at the same time control the intersection of international trade routes in the world, which is our region. So, and for this reason, I believe they were the ones to create Daesh and supply it with all means of power, with military training and with weaponry. And this explains why all of a sudden If we go back to 2014, at the time it seemed as if Syria was about to get over its crisis, and at the same time the situation in Iraq was almost stabilized after the withdrawal of American troops in 2011. All of a sudden we had Daesh taking control of one-third of Iraq and of most of eastern Syria. So how could have this been possible had it not been for the support of a major power? And if we go back to the logistics that Daesh enjoyed, they all came through countries, Western countries or countries allied to the West. So how would have this been possible had it not been for the U.S. and Western support of Daesh in order to serve as a tool against its enemies to destabilize the region and justify one more time American interventionism in our region?
Okay, and on that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us as we take a special look at what has happened since the assassination, since the martyrdom of General Soleimani, the reasons behind it. And of course, we're going to be covering this throughout the next couple of days and looking back and also looking ahead. Appreciate both of you being with us out of Tehran from the University of Tehran, Mr. Hamed Mousavi, and out of Beirut, Professor of International Relations, Lebanese University, Mr. Jamal Waqi. And viewers, we appreciate you staying with us. Don't go away.
Okay, this is Arabi English Radio from Tehran. You've just listened to a special roundtable discussion on the first anniversary of the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. This has been a live event from Press TV. We now go back to our regular programming here on Arabi English Radio.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
Shahid Soleimani turned into the champion of the Iranian nation and the Islamic Ummah. In fact, he taught the people how to use the resistance software and the fighting paradigm, and he promoted them among nations. Well, these are very important and very sensitive roles. This is why he is an outstanding personality and a champion icon in the world of Islam. Both during his lifetime and with his martyrdom, he defeated arrogance. These are not mere claims. These are facts that have been proven. He defeated arrogance in his lifestyle. The reason being that the American President Donald Trump once said, "We spent $7 trillion in Iraq, but we gained nothing." He even had to travel in the dark of night to pay a visit to an American base in Iraq. The whole world believes that the US did not achieve its goals in Iraq and Syria, in particular in Iraq. Why? Who was the agent behind their failure?
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My
It was Soleimani who was the champion. Therefore, he defeated them in his lifetime. Shahid Soleimani defeated them after his martyrdom as well. The burial ceremony that was organized in Iran for him was really astonishing and unforgettable. The same is true for the burial ceremony in Iraq with the presence of millions of Iraqis. They bid farewell to his body in Najaf and Baghdad. With the participation of millions of people, he as well as Shahid Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were bid farewell. That ceremony and the following commemoration events astonished the soft war generals in the camp of arrogance. The outstanding and most influential generals in the soft war of arrogance were astonished to see that incident and they could not understand, in a way, the great movement that defeated them. Of course, what happened following his martyrdom was the first hard slap delivered to the US.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Nigeria, a country facing widespread violence. On the fifth anniversary of the Zaria massacre, many Muslims are still struggling for their rights. The massacre took place in Zaria, Kaduna State, in 2015. After a brutal attack by the Nigerian army, at least 348 civilians were killed, that's according to official tally, and 347 bodies were secretly buried. Welcome to Africa Today. I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya. In this episode, we look at the massacre, asking whether those responsible have been held accountable after 5 years. Apart from that, we delve into Nigeria's quest to end police brutality as the country continues suffering from terror attacks by Takfiri terrorists. Stay tuned.
Zaria massacre. Those killed in Zaria during the notable human rights violation in mid-December 2015 were mostly members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Top Shia cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki was arrested along with his wife Mualima Zina, and many are blaming Saudi Arabia for funding the massacre. The victims were unarmed protesters, and human rights organizations have asserted that the violent crackdown, which continued for 3 days, was carried out without any provocation.
A commission of inquiry inside Nigeria also called for prosecution of all those involved in the killings. Yet, years later, justice is yet to be served. Our first guest is Mr. Masoud Shajare, human rights campaigner at the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Mr. Shajare, welcome to our program. On the fifth anniversary of the massacre, how much do we know about what actually happened on that day?
Well, part of the truth have come out already, even in their own investigation, which was set up almost a year after the massacre. It was a number of things came up. One was the fact that, according to them, over 400 people were massacred, but we've got the actual figure is just under 1,000. And they also admitted that they have dig mass graves, and many people have been buried in those mass graves.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, in the studio, we are also joined by Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic Movement in Nigeria, who will elaborate to us on the situation. Hello, Mr. Abdullahi, and welcome to our program. Now, for a start, can you tell us exactly what is the situation of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, who've been incarcerated now for almost, actually, 5 years?
Yes, the situation is still worse. That is, they were in a worse health condition because there is no appropriate medical attention given to them. And for the Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, recent analysis or recent investigation revealed that he has about 55 foreign body shrapnels, bullet shrapnels in his body.
Not removed yet, yeah.
Yes, none has been removed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he complained of some pain from his head downwards, mm-hmm. and it was said that they must be removed before he can have his mm-hmm. health been improved.
Now, thank you, Mr. Abdullahi, for that elaboration, and stay tuned for more.
The details of the massacre of hundreds of men, women, and children by soldiers in Zaria are gruesome. Some were injured and burned alive, and the bodies of those killed were left littered in the streets. The arrest and prosecution of the military officers involved in the crackdown is part of the movement's quest for justice, which is yet to materialize.
Let us not forget, 5 working days a week, Nigerian Islamic Movement and its supporters come in the street in Abuja and other cities, every single working days, and they've been shot at, they have been gassed, they have been killed, they have been arrested, they have been tortured, but it hasn't stopped.
The Islamic Movement of Nigeria has been a target of the Nigerian government's heavy-handed crackdown from the get-go. The members' peaceful protests are suppressed by military forces as the Nigerian government has banned them as terrorists and detained their leader.
I just hope that we will continue to protest until they let us have contact with them, not show us pictures or give statements in press conferences. They should let us see them. If they don't let us see them, then we don't know that if they're healthy or not. We just know what they tell us. So hopefully the protests are peaceful and that we're not attacking anybody. We're just peacefully protesting that we want to see them and we want to make sure that they're alive. And they're alive and they're getting treatment. And until they allow us to see them, we're not going to trust whatever is it that they say.
Back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. A court, a Nigerian court actually, in Kaduna, has ordered the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, but the government is adamant on continuing to detain him. Is the judiciary really independent in Nigeria?
Well, we cannot say yes. Because if they're independent, the order given must have been complied with. But it seems that they were not independent. And we have seen a lot of things where the court has given an order and mm-hmm. it was not being complied by the
government.
Yes, it's ignored by the government. So we cannot say they are defendant, although we are expecting justice from them in the court.
Thank you. Now, the Islamic Movement in Nigeria has demanded the freedom of their leader through protests staged across Nigeria, including protests in the capital, Abuja. Defying the ban, the Islamic Movement is alive, and we salute in its demand for the freedom of Sheikh Zakzaki. The Muslim leader is indeed an emblem of resistance against injustice in the Islamic world today.
I don't think the power of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, and indeed their commitment, could be destroyed by these tactics. If anything, Islamic movement in Nigeria is now more more prominent. And indeed, many more people in Nigeria see them as a legitimate opposition against corruption, against this sort of dictatorship, and you know, they actually have become more, people have become more supportive towards that.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, many members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria are still missing, I mean, since the massacre in Zaria in 2015 and throughout the years. Now, what is their fate, actually? Do you know, is there any investigation going on? Are there efforts to, you know, find them?
Well, in fact, we don't have any news, any information about them, because we cannot investigate. Though we thought that, we are thinking that they were in some detention facilities in some army barracks, but we don't have categorically an information on that.
And is there a way you can follow up through government agencies?
No, there's none. There's none, but we hope later.
Thank you for that, and stay tuned for more.
In the fifth anniversary of the crimes, those who lost their loved ones are still far from witnessing justice. Zaria has remained an epicenter for the government attempt to disrupt the movement's religious practices. Even peaceful protests are met harshly and trigger massive crackdown. The loss of lives, meanwhile, has been a source of concern not just for the victims' Muslim brothers across the world, but also human rights organizations. This is while there are reports that the Saudi monarchy has been behind the massive crackdown on the movement. In order to promote Wahhabi doctrine, Riyadh is known to fund Salafist initiatives across the Muslim world and beyond.
There was a WikiLeaks document that showed that the Saudi embassies were putting pressure on Nigeria to tackle the ever-growing popularity of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, but also the officials, including the MBS, the prince, have actually said that we have tackled Iran's influence in Africa and Nigeria. And it's very clear that they are involved, they are financing these massacres.
Now, back to the studio with our guest, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, do you think that foreign entities or governments are involved, actually, in the persecution of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria?
Yes, they were really involved, directly and indirectly.
Okay.
The first evidence of their involvement was that immediately after the carnage, there was some information that we had that from one newspaper, American Times, that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has said that they have reduced the influence of Iran in Nigeria by attacking the Islamic movement. This is one of the example of the involvement of foreign entities. Yes. And also, recently, there were some reports that there were some software that was sold to Nigerian government, whereby they can easily track the pulse of people.
From which company this software is? From which company?
I'm not very sure about
it. Or from which country or state?
Unfortunately, I cannot remember that.
Because there were reports that an Israeli company has sold some spy software to the Nigerian government.
Yes, exactly. It's the same report. It's the same report.
Yeah.
Okay. So another thing also is that there is congratulation made by the same person, that is the Prince of the Saudi
Prince
Arabia.
Salman.
Yes, Prince Salman. He said that he's congratulating the Nigerian government that they have made some war against terrorism by the time they attack the Islamic movement. So this and the many other examples were evidences that indicate that there were involvement of foreign entities. Another thing, again, is the silence of the main media. For example, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. In fact, when something less than that happens, they normally broadcast it immediately. Yeah. But this one, they don't
broadcast it. They've given it a blackout.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this one. And another thing is that there are a lot of things that happen and they intervene. Yeah. For example, the bell of Sambo Dasuki, that is a security advisor to the Jonathan.
Yeah.
They just intervene and he was released.
Yeah.
And this is an indication that their silence is an approval of what has been done to Islamic movements. So these are some of the examples.
Thanks for that. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria simply wants the government to do the right thing. The Nigerian government and the military target the Islamic movement, while senseless violence and insecurity caused by the likes of Boko Haram remain to be addressed.
A few years after, you could see by 2010-2011, when the bombings and the attacks started, you know, there was this, I would say, very slow reaction to understanding how deep a threat this was. And then you see by 2013-2014, the attacks got really, really massive, and it blew on our faces when, you know, there was that Chibok incident when, you know, young girls were, over 200 girls were taken, you know, from school. So if you see why the government started building capacity, acquiring weapons, which they hadn't done for many years, and weapons that actually fit into the theater and the threat that they face, you could see that they started making gains.
Farmers are beheaded, schools are attacked, and bandits raid people's homes. The Islamic movement in Nigeria argues that the reason for the failure to address Takfiri militancy or terrorism is the government's dysfunctional system. The military forces appear to be only capable of suppressing peaceful dissent rather than taking on actual criminals. So are the protests effective?
Well, it's extremely effective. I mean, you give me another place around the world that's 5 years with all these brutality, still people come out, still the stand up. People have, you know, given members of their family, not one or two.
Thank you for that, Mr. Masoud Shajare of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. Now, back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. Now, Sheikh Zakzaki has been away, imprisoned for 5 years now. Now, how is the Islamic movement coping with his absence? Is it still continuing with its activities?
Yes, although it is disheartening, the loss of the leader of that kind. However, before he told us that we should continue with what we are doing.
Yeah.
And even before that, he has trained us that not only all things will come from him. We have to have our initiatives.
Yeah.
So all things, all the programs that we accustom, they are progressing. None has stopped.
Oh,
therefore, we cope with that.
So there's no vacuum.
No, there's no vacuum.
Okay, now, as the Islamic movement in Nigeria, are you collaborating with other human rights organizations and civil rights groups in demanding or in pressurizing the Nigerian government to release Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, and also to probe other incidents of persecution of members of the movement?
Yes, there are a lot. All well-meaning people must be sided with the oppressed.
Yeah.
So we have some civil organizations such as the organization headed by Deji Adeyanju.
Okay.
That is called Nigerian Concern Groups. Nigerian Concern Group is we are really working together.
Yeah.
They are involved in our activities of Free Zakzaki campaign.
Yeah.
And most of them were Christians. Most of them are Christian, but we are together.
Yeah.
We are together. And there were individuals also that were normally, you know, they were against the operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, for joining us today to discuss about the state of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and the continued illegal incarceration of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. We are looking forward to his release, and that the calls for free Zakzaki will be listened by the Nigerian government, and he will be released and go back to serve the people and actually the whole society in Nigeria, because I believe he was serving the whole society in Nigeria regardless of religion or sect. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you so much. And thank you for watching.
End SARS protests.
Youths in Nigeria are fed up with the way police forces treat innocent people. The social movement against police brutality and extortion initially called for the disbanding of the Special Robbery Squad, SARS. The notorious unit of the Nigerian police has a long record of abuses. But instead of addressing crimes like armed robbery and kidnappings, the forces resorted to human rights violations, extrajudicial killings, sexual harassment of women, and brutalizing young people.
A couple of Nigerian youths are in the hospital currently in pains, suffering from results of stray bullets shot directly to unarmed protesters.
The bad record by this Nigerian police unit triggered peaceful protests in 2017 that continue to this day, although the government has resorted to a myriad of tactics to derail the movement. But what are the movement's demands, and are they within reach? We invited author and journalist Eric Welberg to share his view. Mr. Welberg, what's your take?
The primary demand is to release all the protesters that have been jailed, and also they want justice. They want compensation for those that were harmed and injured and killed, some of them during protests. They also want an investigation. They asked, they demanded a panel that would investigate the police actions, police brutality. And interestingly enough, they also asked for an increase in police salaries, with the idea to reduce their reliance on bribery and to also make them more accountable for their actions.
SARS has been known for regularly detaining young male Nigerians illegally and extorting money from their relatives. Public outcry returned to social media when video showing a SARS police officer shooting a young Nigerian in front of a hotel went viral in October 2020. The forces have also been accused of widespread torture, mock executions, and other forms of physical and mental abuses. The reform and reorganization of SARS by the government has not only failed to bring an end to the demonstrations, but also infuriated activists across the country, yielding a new phase of the movement.
I think that they have a good possibility of reform, because it's they're strong. They've got 100 years of tradition. The first big demonstrations of Nigerian women were in 1929, and it was against colonial attempts to squeeze market women, of course, dominating the market in Nigeria, and the British colonial government tried to siphon off more money from them.
Protests that swept the country in October against police brutality appear to be coming back. Among the protesters' top demands are the release of all those arrested in the peaceful protests. They are also seeking justice and compensation for all those who lost their lives due to police brutality.
Well, this protest against police brutality, the big place for that's happening is in the United States, but also in Britain, in Europe, in France, there are a lot of protests of police brutality. So I think there is a general groundswell of anger, and these women have really pushed to the forefront in protesting police brutality in Nigeria. So that's a good sign, but they're very angry. They had the same promises in 2017 and 2018, so nothing really seemed to have happened. So I don't know if this time they will succeed.
Now, the movement that started as an effort to reform police now looks like the beginning of a youth awakening in Nigeria. Women are also playing a key role in the movement as diverse communities unite behind one goal to form the backbone of the end SARS protests.
We're here because we believe in what we're fighting for. We're firm to it. And, you know, if you listen to our national anthem and our national pledge, we are here to defend our unity.
We are fighting for the truth. We are fighting for the labor of our heroes' past. We don't want it to be in vain.
I prefer to die well for my children to have a better tomorrow. The truth is it.
There have been lots of graphic footage showing police and army officers shooting and abusing protesters. The activists are now wary of bad governance involving vows to investigate killings while simultaneously discrediting reports of abuses. There are meanwhile efforts underway to organize a network of lawyers to provide free legal support to protesters and victims of police abuses across the country. That's the end of today's program. We hope to see Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife out of prison to join their family, friends, and companions. And we wish peace and prosperity for the people of Nigeria. Goodbye for now, and God bless you all.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth.
Allahu Ya.